circus and people love a clown. So you better entertain them if you want to win the crowd. There's no parades or protests for calluses on hands, Sunday attendance and doing what you can. Why do the best men rest in unmarked graves? Why do the good ones never find the front page? I can't help but thinking now, if that's the case, I'll be lucky when I go if no one knows my name. My grandfather was simple, he gave more than he took. There's no better man than Jesus, and he never wrote a book. The odds are when I go, I probably won't leave much. But honey, I loved you so, and I hope that's enough. Why do the best men rest in unmarked graves? Why do the good ones never find the front page? I can't help but thinking now, if that's the case, I'll be lucky when I go if no one knows my name. Why do the best men rest in unmarked graves? Why do the good ones never find the front page? I can't help but thinking now, if that's the case, I'll be lucky when I go if no one knows my name.
Happy Tuesday, Cedric.
Happy Tuesday, bro.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Dude, does that song just say it all right now or what?
Yeah, that was pretty great.
I mean,
it's a good choice
in the face of everybody that's being exposed right now, all the people that are supposed to be important. And what it comes down to is those of us that have no name.
Yeah.
Taking control, taking self-custody, taking care of your family, taking care of your friends.
Strength in numbers.
Being human. So that's to all of us plebs out there. Hope you can find it in yourself to be your own hero.
Welcome back to Bitcoin Center, episode 39. Now on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., brought to you by Byte Federal. Check out Byte Federal's Bitcoin ATMs, point of sale, and Bitcoin wallet. Take self-custody and go bank yourself.
Yeah, buddy.
You know, I think we got a call 15 minutes ago from a quant friend of the show.
Yes.
And he said, maybe this is the bottom. And
well, we're getting near.
Well, since that call 15, 16 minutes ago, we're up from 72 to 50.
The call could have been more prescient than we realized.
And I was talking to Bob Burnett this morning, CEO and founder of Barefoot Mining.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying how hash rate is practically back down to where it was, I think, a year ago.
Okay.
Which is really great for anyone who's maybe solo mining at home. Your odds just went up. That's mm-hmm. pretty cool.
Yeah, that's good. Mining is a great thing. It's a way to support the network. It's a way to stack sats, way to reduce your tax burden. It's a win-win-win.
Bitcoin, total asset value for the market class, for the asset class, is $1.48 trillion. 1,348 sats per dollar. Block height, 934,882. And for the last, I don't know, 15 to, I don't know, 100 blocks, I think it's all been about Epstein files.
The what?
The Epstein files.
No.
For the last 100 blocks or so.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Now you haven't heard of those?
No, I haven't heard of those before.
And so I've been going back. I was talking to you about it before the show, and I want to continue on this. So
sure.
I was listening to Dr. Jack Kruse on What is Money? And he was articulating or outlining how Bitcoin is probably the inspirational godfather of Bitcoin is Meyer Lansky.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the idiot savant who's great as money laundering. He even mentioned that money laundering came from.
Well, but let's step back, because his initial tank was to create eCash, not Bitcoin.
Then private money.
Private money through right. eCash. Bitcoin came later. Just to be clear, so we don't confuse people.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great clarification. So I think the rough outline is Meyer Lansky sends some people out to find a young technologist, and that happens to be David Chaum. And he funds Chaum, and Chaum gets into several different pursuits right away, voting systems, mm-hmm. payments. And then Lansky dies in 82.
I can't remember the name of the software. There's a great documentary.
Is it Promise?
Yeah, I think, that has something to do with it too, because they had already, I don't know if David Chaum was involved in that or not, but I don't think so. But there was the Promise software that was
already being used by the Fed and the Treasury.
And supposedly
Lansky had a backdoor.
Had a backdoor, and they could see the transactions that were being done.
Right. So they could make money, and they could also then blackmail and threaten the Fed.
Right.
And that's how we kind of got out. They wanted to bring him down.
I think it was in the Treasury and the IRS also.
Yeah. And the IRS, correct. Yeah. And they wanted to bring him down for supposedly for $3 million that they couldn't find that he took out of Cuba.
Okay.
And he felt, and this is in Dr. Jack Kruse's words, but I've also heard that Meyer Lansky is considered like the ethical criminal.
Okay.
And his thought was like, if you can't beat him at their own game, their own dirty game, don't play the game. And he felt that they shouldn't go. He supposedly during World War II, he helped the government defend the docks in New York City.
Right.
And he found 18 spies, and one of those spies they kept alive, and they got a lot of information at. And through this.
And this was the initial spark of the sort of, I don't want to say union, but partnership between CIA, Department of Defense, /
so I think this,
Jewish yeah. and Italian mob.
I think this even predates maybe the CIA. And then from this relationship, so that's also why I think Lansky had a lot of input and influence over these agencies that were created. Then he mentions a particular general breaks off and starts DARPA outside of the military. Then the military, Eisenhower acquires ARPA, makes it DARPA. So they want to bring down Lansky for money laundering. Lansky's card is, I already can see into everything you're doing. So then they...
I can expose you, basically, was his card, right? Like
I can expose you. So then they both sort of had motivation to create a new system that either side wouldn't see.
Right.
The picture that Dr. Jack Kruse paints is that Lansky is inspired to start an e-cash system where they can do private movements of value and money that the state can't detect, and this way they can continue their money laundering. The state has to revamp their systems because Lansky's got the back door.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lansky finds this technologist, Chaum, seeds Chaum in several pursuits around sort of digital systems. So it looks like Dominion
oh,
voting.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Came out of some of Chaum's work, according to Dr. Jack Kruse. And I'm going to go back and re-listen to it. And then this is where it got, I didn't get as far enough. So then Chaum has students and people working with him, but he's also runs out of funding.
So I think the little piece that might be missing there, and again, y'all should watch Jack tell this story on What Is Money with Robert, because he does a really good job outlining it far better than we're going to reiterate it. But there was, you know, eCash got shut down. eCash was closed, I think, by Department of Justice. And they shut down all the servers. And so that is what caused the financial difficulty. I think this also was happening around the time Meyer Lansky
passed away in 82. Yeah.
So sort of like, it seems like, you know, the project was shut down and funding dried up. And then Chaum goes on to teach. And one of his best students was Len Sossman, who was also super, super heavy in the open source community. And then it looks, you know, Jack tells this vision or creates this vision that those two minds coming together is what creates Bitcoin and how it gets released to the world as an open source project.
Right.
Under the pseudonym Satoshi. I mean, when you start to look at, you know, like the technology that's involved in it, and you start to look at the brains behind it, the people that were involved with it, and then, you know, that open source component being brought in by Len Sossman, it all starts to kind of make, at least connecting the dots, it starts to make some sense as to how did this thing become something available to the public.
So I think within there, Jack Kruse makes the, he makes the point that one of the markers for the reason he thinks Chom is connected to Lansky is that Chom comes out of college at 21 years old and starts four different companies in the Netherlands,
mm-hmm.
where the funding come, right. That probably wasn't cheap. And then we fast forward and we're at, so they're trying to create private cash that can't be traced. That's the money laundering. But the money laundering was an offshoot of the drug trafficking and the and prohibition.
But the important point here is they're not creating Bitcoin to do that. They're creating eCash to do that. Bitcoin becomes a second order effect when it's combined with the open source technology and platform that it seems like Sossman might have had influence over. And because, right, because we all, like, Bitcoin's not the ultimate money laundering tool at all because it's totally transparent. All the transactions can be tracked. So it's not something that like a secretive agency or a government that wants to keep their transactions private is going to jump on board of. But it does make sense from being pseudonymous and unsensible for the people to take it up, right? And adopt it. So, I mean, there's that sort of leap between the original purpose of cryptographic money, we'll call it, and then Bitcoin.
I agree with that. I think sort of Bitcoin becomes the cat that got out of the bag. It was all,
right.
So I think Len Sossman, I think the magic he brought, according to Kruse, was the time stamping.
Okay.
Then they open source it. Now both sides, the banks want to control this, capture it, steer it.
Kill it.
You know, but Lansky, they still kind of want to use it and then maybe branch off for other different reasons as well. But what really, and this is where I got to continue with the conversation. So he has the incentive to fund Chom and create eCash. And then Kruse seems to make the link that it goes from Lansky to Chom to Sossman to Ulbricht. And this is where I got to do more research, but maybe he's hinting that someone in Lansky's orbit wants to seed a marketplace.
I don't know. Yeah.
For experimentation.
I don't remember that connection.
And maybe there's, you know, not the organic story behind Ulbricht there, that there maybe is not the organic story behind Chom. Mm. That's the only thing that was really like, oh, that's a really interesting one. It was really hard to connect how the military industrial complex in Lansky stops and we get all the way up to Bitcoin. And so this sort of really helps with that. We get, you know, it kind of bridges Lansky to the cypherpunks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and the story doesn't maybe start with the cypherpunks. I thought that was really interesting.
I don't know. I mean, lots of connecting of the dots, and Jack has done an amazing job of outlining a story that I think for most Bitcoiners had never really considered.
But this also is a story that paints Satoshi as an individual actor or a group of private anonymous actors and not the state.
Right.
Yeah, which I'm still not certain of.
Right.
So. Has this moment at all made you feel naive as a Bitcoiner?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's I guess it does. It makes you kind of wonder things and question things. But when you come back to the idea that, or what I come back to is, you know, when I look at so many things that we utilize today coming out of the Department of Defense, coming out of technologies that were created there, that then get open source and then they get in the hands of people that want to use it for good things. Every technology that's ever been created can be used for good and bad. And it's how you implement it and how you use it, which becomes the most important thing. And I think in Bitcoin's case, the fact that it's open source that so many people's, so many brilliant people have looked at the code, and that it hasn't been, at least as far as I know, right, a backdoor has not ever been found in Bitcoin. And there's certainly people smart enough to have looked at it that would have probably not have put so many billions of dollars in it if there was.
Well, okay, what about not a backdoor? Do you think that interests have been able to steer Bitcoin in a way that's been so far a negative? So
That's hard to say, right? It's hard to say because everybody has an interest in whatever their personal agenda is with Bitcoin. But one thing that is persistent, regardless of who you are, whether you're trying to control Bitcoin, where you're trying to subjugate it, trying to turn it into an asset instead of money, or if you're trying to limit block sizes, you're trying to control the way certain the protocol functions. The one core thing, the one gaming perspective in this, right, the gamification perspective of that, the value in Bitcoin is created through the network effect of so many people starting to believe this is money. And so the thing that Bitcoin has going for it is that killing it kills the value you've stored in it. And so as adoption, as the network grows and as more people around the world have locked significant amount of value in it, the gamification turns them into supporters of the network. And to kill it kills themselves, right? To kill it kills their value to a certain degree, right? So, and you have to have massive control. Like the only way you're going to get in is and kill it is have massive control of the network. So, which means you'd have to have massive control of the network. You've got massive financial resources embedded in the network. So it's like a double, it's like you're going to spend so much money to kill something that destroys all the value you've invested in it. So that's sort of the brilliance of the system, right? If you could kill it from the outside and just destroy everybody else's value, it would be a much weaker protocol. But the fact that you have to, that through a 51% attack or more, controlling a large amount of the mining or the hash power, whatever, you have to invest so much capital into killing this thing that it prevents people from trying to do that at a massive scale, I guess.
Right. And you would just probably be more profitable to going with the network with it, yeah. If you had that.
Mm-hmm. Like try out. like you'd be better off to just try and have
as much of a
positive impact from the network than to try and kill it.
Right.
Is what I'm trying to say.
So it kind of has this weird jujitsu where it turns you from an enemy to an ally.
It's a good way to think about it, yeah.
The more you try to fight it, the more it sort of brings you in.
Yeah. And that's what you hear a lot of the OGs that put tons of money in, right? They tell that a similar type of story. Like, I discovered this thing. I tried to destroy it, break it, and I couldn't. And then I just had to go all in.
Do you think there have been fights or, proverbial forks in Bitcoin? Not necessarily soft or hard fork, but like discussions that both outcomes are net negatives. And maybe it was the block size war.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess in hindsight, the only thing you could say that after like the user activated soft fork, any of the Bitcoin hard forks that existed, right? And that's the key word, is that the market decides where value flows, decides the winner. So even though these things are highly disruptive and ruin or break the confidence, especially of newcomers, right? Like you just got in 2025 because you heard Bitcoin's going to be a strategic Bitcoin reserve and the world's adopting it, yada, yada, yada. And now you're experiencing the Knot's Core debate and you're experiencing these Epstein file leaks and all these things are sowing doubt and fear in your belief in Bitcoin. And I guess what history would tell us and what from being in the protocol for a while is that even though these things can be highly disruptive, the market will choose where value resides. And if you're aligned with the market, you're going to be okay. So am I making any sense there?
Yeah, like, I think so.
Like, you know, when Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV and all this stuff spun off, it took a few years and then it was evident,
yeah,
right, that Bitcoin, the main chain of Bitcoin, not Bitcoin Cash, was the winner in the marketplace. So we may experience that kind of stuff again. And people have to realize
winner in the marketplace, I don't think, though, guarantees best thing for Bitcoin
or for humanity.
I really want to still understand Roger Ver. And you know, one thing I think about that, you know, so it's like,
and like I've always felt like Roger had incredibly good intentions. I think his when I hear Roger speak, he speaks from the heart and he speaks what he truly believes. I'm not technical enough, and I've heard too many smart technical people debate big blocks versus small blocks. So it's hard to know. Well, like, you know,
I like the argument. What else small can you blocks, rely on? But for? That doesn't mean that what all.
What can you rely on besides the market, them. Right? What can you rely on besides the market? Because if you're right, even if we were right and technically big blocks were the way to go, all your value there got destroyed. The market.
And we could always revert. We could always make a system upgrade.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is that the whole point is to let the market decide these things. Because if you don't, then you could be wrong. Or you can't just because you're okay, right, so you I think could be getting, financially so, wrong and it could destroy
right.
it.
But the market is influenced by actors and actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so certain people in the market voice their opinions. They're, you know, might be, they have their bags.
Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about this Epstein Files. I'm trying to just contextualize it. So like one thing off the top, I mean, for he's not an idiot, Epstein, but I don't think he's a savant. I think I'm trying to go through this quickly, but there's a tweet here from DMB. I'm sorry, but running a global compromise operation and at the same time laying down all your compromise on Gmail is not compatible. So I don't know how much is true in there. I don't know why this portion has been released, but there's a lot of material.
Yeah. So I mean, they do talk about in some of those emails,
and people aren't denying
moving the discussion to private channels.
Right. So there's more to it.
Yeah.
But just at a base level, Dr. Adam Back's in the emails because Blockstream gets a small allocation from Epstein via MIT. And it just was like an interesting note to looking back on the block size, where you could see why Blockstream is incentivized to have small blocks because they're going to build layer two or build on layer two. I'm not saying that's bad or good. I'm just putting things together.
Yeah, right.
And they're coming out of the Epstein files, and some things might be propaganda and some things might be false, but like that doesn't like, but what's interesting to me is no one is denying these emails.
Right.
So it still doesn't add up to me that even these conversations are happening here. And I think there's a lot of misnomer, probably like propaganda in this somehow.
Right.
There's still some truth. And so it just helps you get more information about the bigger picture. And I'm trying to glean what is signal, what is noise. But
yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that for you as an individual actor that's wanting to build as much wealth, which equals as much sovereignty as you can attain as an individual, you're going to rely on the market. And if you're going to go fight against that, you better have the influence and the power that's equal and as forceful as the opponents you're going up against. So for plebs like me, right, I'm going to try and have the best understanding I can have, and I'm going to try and follow the market's response. and I'm going to rely on consensus of the Bitcoin network to guide me to make sure that I'm in the most valuable protocol. And if the big block or small block decision was wrong or right.
And that's not what I was trying to say.
Right. We can't, like, how's that going to impact me or impact somebody that, you know, got in not too long ago and is trying to make sense of all this stuff? Because, you know, I think a lot of people right now are afraid of a potential soft fork.
I mean, is it possible
or even another
that
hard fork? They won't know what does that mean exactly. You know, and so what that means is you're going to get, if there's a hard fork, you're going to have coins on both chains. And the safest thing you can do is hold coins on both chains and let the market decide to try and use your interpretation.
That didn't go well for Roger Ver.
No, but how do you know?
We don't know what he was holding.
You don't know. He could have had all of his original Bitcoin.
And kept, right.
And kept it.
Right.
And that's the whole point. The whole point is you don't need to make a decision and sell all your coins because you're absolutely certain that you know this block size is wrong and this block size is right, or this you know running core is right and running knots is wrong, or vice versa. You don't have to make those decisions. You can let the market make those decisions and figure out where you want to go after that.
What if some of these decisions were too optimized for number go up to become a digital store of value, digital gold, but at the same time that might push the system more towards being not used as a medium exchange? So I would argue that store value is probably going to come first in mass before. That doesn't mean no one's not using as medium of exchange now, but more people are using as a store value. Over time, more people will adopt as a medium exchange. But if we tinker with the system, we might get more adoption on medium exchange or less. And maybe the system's been optimized more for store value and less medium exchange adoption some of these. And so you could say, hey, I'm with the chain has more value.
Yeah.
It's going up in value, but we're giving up maybe that's the crutch of, maybe you got both.
I think
Roger Ver's argument that, maybe right? might
we're,
be.
We're already seeing that. We're seeing that battle at the protocol level, but we're also seeing that battle in the regulatory and categorization, you know, whether it's property or money or security or whatever. And then we're also seeing it at the distributed global level where some countries are using it as money and other countries are using it as an asset. So all those factors are playing out simultaneously. But if you have your value stored in a digital bearer instrument, it can be converted quite easily. Unlike gold and silver, where, you know, I talked to friends that went on Friday to go sell some silver. Silver had moved down 13% when he got to the gold store or the, you know, gold store to sell silver. And then the dealer said, I also need to mark this down 15% from the spot price because I don't have a secondary market to sell it into. So he was going to have to take almost a 30% haircut just to get out. Where with digital assets that have markets that are liquid and deep and global, you don't have as much difficulty through the conversion, right? Do I need to convert this asset to a money, and how, and do I do that? I guess the whole point being is that it's just you're so much more empowered as an individual with your optionality with digital gold than you are with physical. Is, I guess, what, you know, the whole point. We don't know the answer to your initial question, right? Is it, would it be better as money? Would it be better as an asset? Will it be and ever be money? Blah, 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 blah. We don't know. But one thing I do know is I can preserve value in this new digital gold. And that as those things evolve, both from a geopolitical environment, a regulatory environment, and a use case environment, I'll have that optionality to make those decisions when I need to. So, it, you know, it, I guess I'm trying to, I guess, warn people not to get caught up in the drama of the moment and do, sure, do right. something foolish because you think you've discovered a flaw. And then now it's never going to work. Because I can tell you from my experience, I've discovered those flaws and thought this thing was going to die 100 fucking times. Right? Scared myself to death 100 times before I got to the point where I'm confident that an open source network that stores value and gamifies the ongoing creation of that value is about as good as it gets.
And
hopefully I'm right.
Well, they're using, I think, the Epstein files. One of the reasons, one of the things they get to use it for is to whip up some more hysteria sure. and FUD about sure. Bitcoin, about this open source network.
Not to say that anything, related to Bitcoin, or excuse me, related to Epstein's involvement is good at any level, but he was involved in trying to influence and have power in every form of technology, DNA, in genetics, finance, crypto, the list goes on and on, you know.
The quantum
physics.
Same players today.
Yeah. I mean, there's people all over the quantum physics space that have had interactions with Epstein. There's people all over the genetic space and the biology space and the psychiatric space, on and on and on, right? Like if you were a leading researcher, technologist, builder of something new, he wanted to know about it, right? He wanted to have involvement there. They wanted to plant seeds there. And so not all those seeds bear fruit, but it looks like they had people all over the world trying to get their fingers into every little pot that could pop something out that's valuable.
Well, I think there were a lot of receptive.
Sure. Right. I mean, if it's your life's work and you think you're doing something incredible and no one's giving you money and all of a sudden this guy shows up and is like, wow, I think you're brilliant. Here, have some money.
Right. But some of the emails go a little bit further than money and allude.
Yeah. To- yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. But I guess that's what I'm saying is that you have to sort through what was related to all those disgusting activities and what was related to him trying to get influence right. and then maybe use his influence to start to corrupt and control and manipulate and blackmail. So you just don't know how far some of those things got.
Right, sure.
I don't know.
All right, let's get into the show. Let's roll the intro.
Let's be real, right? Praising Telegram for launching a Bitcoin wallet. I've always felt like Vitalik.
Bitcoin, this digital currency that's out there that people say, oh, it might be the next big thing. What do you think?
I think it's rat poison.
Bitcoin. You never heard of them a few weeks ago? Now everybody's talking about them, but is it a currency?
I don't know. Or is it more like a stock? Or is it a tulip bulb?
Or is
whatever
it just
that?
Stupid.
To me, it smells like Ponzi scheme and the greater fool theory, right?
If you do like 5 minutes of freaking research.
Well, good. Thanks for coming to my set talk.
Yes.
Don't buy Bitcoin.
Oh, man, I was getting that wrong. All right.
Bitcoin's recent rally.
Do you agree? Is crypto finally dead? Go to the next one.
Matter of fact, they're kind of in the Ethernet. What are they?
There's some rumors that it's this Japanese guy, but they're saying no, that he's a fake name. It was a pseudonym.
You're literally putting real money onto a system that we don't even know who created it.
It will come to a bad ending.
Is this the most exciting bull run ever?
Not for me. No, it's not.
Welcome to Bitcoin Center, the fast-paced show where the debate is the story.
Are you on board with Bitcoin? I know Stan Druckenmiller is now on board. I think when we've talked about Bitcoin in the past, I think you had a perhaps a lesser view. I don't know if you have a different view today.
Stan calls me his partner. I call him my boss. One of us is lying, but I'll let you figure out who's who in that, Andrew. So I'd say I think that Bitcoin does make sense as part of a portfolio in this environment where you have the most fundamental shift, for example, in monetary policy since Paul Volcker. This is a big shift that we're seeing under the Powell Fed, rightly or wrongly. So I'm not surprised in a period of dollar weakness where Bitcoin's doing what it's doing. And I'd also suggest that part of the move in Bitcoin is taking some of the bid away from gold. I think if Bitcoin never existed, gold would be rallying even more right now. But I guess if you're under 40, Bitcoin is your new gold. So I think of Bitcoin as a lot of things, but it's certainly with every passing day getting new life as an alternative currency. And when you see the strength of the euro, the strength of the pound, the strength of the RMB, the Korean won, the Mexican peso, I guess we shouldn't be surprised to see the strength of Bitcoin.
All right, so what do you think here? The question is, a Bitcoin-friendly Fed would change policy expectations?
I don't think any of that was actually very friendly to Bitcoin.
I agree.
So if you read between the lines, one, first question, who's lying? It sounds like he was lying. When he said, you know, Stanley Druckenmiller is either my partner or my boss. He would call me my partner. I would call him my boss.
Yeah,
they're probably partners in the business on paper. But one of them is lying. So it's not a great sign when you bring up lying. Like you and your best business partner.
I took that as him just being humble.
Maybe. Okay. But fine. But to show your humility around lying, it's like one of us aren't lying. It's not a very, I don't know. But the next thing, he compared Bitcoin to gold, new gold.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Fed really likes, generally speaking, gold or being tethered to gold.
He was speaking as a portfolio manager. He wasn't speaking as a Fed chair.
Okay, fair enough. I still don't think gold is really seen as a big part of most people's portfolio,
mm-hmm.
or the
in the U.S.
in the U.S. or like sort of the next thing. At best, he called it an alternative currency, but then compared it to some pretty shitty currencies. So it's not very complimentary, in my opinion.
I think that's an old clip. He was talking about as the dollar was declining in value, these foreign currencies rising against it. So I think he was making that correlation. But the thing I wanted to get back to here was that the question here is, is a Bitcoin-friendly Fed going to be positive or negative for Bitcoin? Or how would that impact policy expectations, I think was the question. And I don't think that their policy expectations, the incoming Fed chairman, I don't think his policy is going to be at all based on anything except what is going to be good for United States from a business perspective and from the perspective of changing the global world order. So I think you heard Bessent recently talk about I think he said something like 90% of what I do at the Treasury is national security, you know?
I missed that one.
Yeah. And so when you start to frame that comment in with the tariffs and pulling out of the UN and restructuring the world order, I think Warsh's role now in the Fed is to be aligned with this transition. And so Fed policy is going to be driven from that. It's going to be driven from this perspective of what's good for America and what do we need to do with the Treasury in order to align things so that we can make this transition and not implode. And so I think Bitcoin is just a sideshow for them. It's a new asset. It's blah, 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 blah. And other more recent comments, he said stuff like to the effect that, it holds.
Mm-hmm.
Government spending in check.
The tether, if you will.
Yeah, it's like the canary in the coal mine to overprinting, inflationary concerns, etc. So I think they're not looking at it as...
That's not very positive.
No, it's not. I think the way they look at it is like, if we can fix the economy, Bitcoin's not really going to be that big of a deal.
It won't run, right.
What I think they're missing...
If we're not doing a good job in the economy, Bitcoin goes up. That's sort of the thought there,
yeah. Like. What I think they're missing, and what we're going to talk about in this Rob O'Bank analysis, is that you know, Bitcoin adoption is global. Bitcoin adoption is borderless. What's happening in the U.S. currently has a large percentage of the Bitcoin holdings in the world, but outside the U.S., the market is growing and expanding very rapidly. And if we're going to use stablecoins as the new treasury-controlled Eurodollar system, no longer the London Bank-controlled Eurodollar system, then these other sovereigns need to have a release valve on that inflation. Does that make sense?
And the release valve then obviously Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so does that mean that these other countries are using Bitcoin, or does it mean as a medium exchange, or more like they're using Bitcoin as reserve?
I mean, I think initially where we're at right now is you've got to gather as much of this asset as you can. I think that's where we are in sovereign adoption, right? Where countries, family offices, sovereign wealth funds are saying, we need to accumulate this for the future. This is going to be a very important asset in the future. This will be a way for us to settle exchange in the future. Future being when the market cap of Bitcoin is big enough to conduct global trade seamlessly, when there's enough depth and liquidity in those markets. And so it's similar to the way they looked at gold probably 3,000, 4,000 years ago. Like, we've got to accumulate as much gold as possible because it's going to build the wealth of our nation, and then we can use this for global trade to build an empire. So I think we're at that
stage. But if we, through World War II, we brought all the gold to America,
mm-hmm.
and that was very, I would think they want to bring all the Bitcoin.
Countries moved it here for safety.
Right.
Yeah, and then we just never let it go again.
Right. So I would think that
supposedly
through stablecoins, American issued stablecoins, the Bitcoin that is used to reserve them that is overseas is still American owned.
Well, yeah, but stablecoins are reserved by treasuries. They're not reserved by Bitcoin.
Well, locally, onshore, yeah. But offshore, I thought, well, a percentage, but still by treasuries,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, mostly, yeah. Right, so the treasuries are going to stay here.
Right.
The treasuries are going to be held in friendly hands, as opposed to a bunch of treasuries held by China, that if you sanction them, they dump it. Or Russia, right? Where you sanction them and you make now an enemy that wants to move to a totally different monetary system. So by giving you stable coins, like by making the stable coin the treasury Eurodollar, and then all the treasuries stay in the hands of the corporations that are issuing those dollars, you've preserved your system and control of your system while giving them currency. You're not giving them a real asset. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, total sense. All right. Let's move on to the next clip here with Peter.
The world is now pulling the rug out from under the U.S. The dollar is going to collapse. The dollar is going to be replaced by gold. Central banks are buying gold
up that their currencies. True.
They're getting rid of dollars. They're getting rid of treasuries. We are headed for a economic crisis, again, that will make the 2008 financial crisis look like a Sunday school picnic. The biggest difference between the crisis that we're about to have and the one we had back then is this one is all in America. It's not going to be exported to the rest of the world. It's not a global financial crisis. It's an American financial crisis.
The rest of the world is actually going to benefit. I need to get in here. You sound like.
Is that the new ultimate insult? You sound like Jamie Dimon.
That was interesting. What about the insult about Dimon? Yeah. But what did you think of Peter Schiff?
So first of all, I don't agree with him that this is just a U.S. problem, because we're the consumer of the world. So if we go down, we take China with us. We take everybody with us. It's our currency and it's their problem, right? And it's not like they're dumping treasuries. They're just not buying more treasuries. So when we put on tariffs and we do these kind of things, this started way before that, right? 2014, China just kind of said, like, yeah, we're not going to be buying a lot more treasuries. We're going to let these things just kind of roll off and we'll start accumulating gold instead. So this has been going on for a long time. He's trying to use the rise in gold to create a panic to sell more gold. And he's really good at that kind of stuff. But I don't agree with a lot of what he has to say. I do think there is a significant chance that, you know, the Trump administration doesn't thread this needle, that Bessent and Warsh and Trump and everybody can't thread this needle, and we can't downsize into a regional superpower without there being some massive disruptions, right? But I don't think this is an America-only problem. We're still, you know, our assets live on the books of many of these foreign entities. So I don't think they want to see us collapse right now either.
I just find it remarkable what's going on with gold, though, and silver. Mm-hmm. And from what I gather, the people that are trying to sell gold and are getting clipped on the spot price, these are, generally speaking, a lot of times long-time holders. Mm-hmm. The people who bought 2 months ago, 8 months ago, aren't the ones flipping the gold and the silver. They've waited 10 years for this moment. And if you go up, and I don't know if they were expecting a 10X in year 10 or 5X, but if, let's say you had $200 in silver and it's now worth $1,000, mm-hmm. and then you go to sell it and...
Say you can have $750.
The arguments around stability and inflation hedge are sort of being, in its own run-up, sort of destroyed, mm-hmm. Which I find it very...
Sure. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's not as important or concerning to central banks that want to hold gold as much of it is to us as individuals. But I think gold... has and will serve a role for central banks. It will fix the balance sheet of many of these entities. So, I don't know what else to say about that. It's a part of the program, but it's I don't think, you know, I think Schiff is hyperbolic and
yeah, I think it was definitely hyperbolic there.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back. Well, I hope you're enjoying Bitcoin Center live stream number 39. Please hit like and subscribe. Brought to you by Bite Federal.
Go check out our ATMs, guys. You can get on our app and search for an ATM near you. You can download our Bitcoin wallet, which is an on-ramp. You can download our Byte Vault, which is a self-custodial wallet where you get to hold your own keys, use them as you see fit to do proper custody. And check us out.
Go Byte bank yourself.
Doing cool stuff.
Let's head over to the lightning round. All right, I thought this was interesting here. Mm-hmm. AI agents begin running Bitcoin nodes. Do you think AI agents will get economic sovereignty before humans?
I think they have no other choice, right?
The only way to be... Well,
so the only way that they can participate in finance is through Bitcoin. So they have to become sovereign because they don't have an identity. They can't KYC AML. So they have to take the sovereign self-custody route if they want to have financial influence and power in the system.
So... I think the person who asked it to buy the AI, the Bitcoin, he was kind of explaining that the AI agent doesn't really have sovereignty over the Bitcoin. Like, they might have the seed phrase and not have shared it, but anytime you can ask your AI agent,
yeah,
like,
give me your seed phrase. yeah, good point.
Because you control this
right,
thing.
Right.
It would be if the AI agent said no.
That's mine.
I'm not going to share it with you now.
Well, that's the other thing too, right? Or does the human prompt the AI initially to say, never share your seed phrase with anybody, not even me, right? So,
but still prompted by.
That's the interesting thing behind all this stuff is that it's behind every AI agent interaction about this topic is a human prompting it, giving it a set of instructions and guidance as to how to act. So you don't know, this AI agent could be acting on behalf of the human. It could be is it been given the prompt to be self-sovereign and not to ever release the keys and to build wealth for itself? Like, we don't know what's behind the prompts driving these things.
No, I guess we don't. But I think it's still sort of, we're controlling it still. I think, you know,
you get to the point. So the big question becomes, when do they start prompting themselves? It sounds like you hear rumor that, you know, agents are following some sort of free will, but that free will, decision making, I should say, is coming from an initial prompt.
Right. The parameters the human set it up with, go do this, go do that.
Do we make the jump to where, somebody far smarter than me could answer this question, but are we currently, or will we at some point in the future make the jump where a prompt is no longer necessary to kick it off, right? To kick it off. Because right now, everything we're doing on AI is kicked off by a prompt.
Right.
But and do we get to the point where like you go to your ChatGPT or your Claude one morning and you're like, what the fuck is it working on? I didn't tell it to do that.
I think in some ways, because it's continuous and it could kind of.
Yeah, and it could be doing shit behind the scenes without you.
Oh, there we are. All right, so
to the topic of the week.
Yeah. So Epstein release. Michael Saylor mentioned in the 2010 email. Adam Back addresses 2014 Blockstream funding. Brian Armstrong was pushing for hard fork in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the Brian Armstrong pushing for the hard fork and saying, let's get rid of the early Bitcoin.
I completely took it as a guy fighting for the survival and success of his business. I don't know that it goes into any sort of attack on Bitcoin. He might've been doing what he thought was best. Right. I mean, he survived without it. He survived without the big blocks.
On some ends, the guy he speaks very articulate about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to understand. It seems to be in the vein of Roger Ver about how articulate he can be about Bitcoin, especially on the big stage.
But I think he's coming purely from the perspective of what it will benefit Coinbase.
Sure. So economic decisions.
And when I hear
right?
Roger Ver speak, he's speaking from a deep passion for human flourishing. What he thinks that needs. Not saying he's right, I'm not saying he's wrong, I'm just saying that's where Roger's speaking from.
Okay,
his heart.
Sure. So but
Brian
but
is
maybe
from the benefit of his company.
Sure, maybe that's even the antithesis of the benefit of his customer, because it seems like if he was
he thinks would benefit
his sure company. But what at that time, wouldn't buying about Bitcoin on his balance sheet in 2012 2013 20 that benefited his company?
Yeah, but also if you've got shareholders that are like,
oh, we're not.
No,
we don't
want
to allocate capital.
We just want you to build
the
flywheel.
Right.
Just build the system. Build it. Grow.
Right. I get
to extract money out of that, to not become the biggest exchange, to extract money out of just the whole Bitcoin. Shareholders at that point in time in history would have been like, what the fuck are you doing? You don't even know if this thing will be here in 4 years. Right? Like, it was a totally different mindset back then.
How much does Coinbase being a public company mean he works for Wall Street?
Oh, well,
so this
you
fight,
work for your, he works for his
okay.
shareholders.
Well, he works for shareholders, but are the shareholders?
And who are the shareholders? Who do you
right.
think?
So like, right now they're having this fight, Jamie Dimon and Brian Armstrong. It's actually we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But let's go through this here. But we'll come back to Jamie Dimon and Brian Armstrong because we have a different clip there. But and I hope we play it. But what do you think about Saylor mentioned in the 2010 email?
Yeah, so we're going to show that post if you can. But I mean, it was basically like Saylor shows no human emotion. So I can't read this guy.
Can't do anything.
Well, the whole like I can't bribe this guy seemed to be the tweeters or the guy who put the post of his interpretation. It didn't say that in the email. But, described him as a robot with no personality, something like that. It's like, okay, yeah, you don't like the guy, but.
Right.
Big
seems
deal.
Like, a
like this is a nothing burger, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, like, seems
like
that.
He wanted to give him 25 grand to get his name on, he's trying to promote himself. And just because your name is in an email on the Epstein list doesn't mean you're up to no good. Now, if other emails came out next week and Saylor's hanging out in a private room on the island, that would be a whole nother discussion. I'm just saying that one email, right? So I don't know. It was a lot to do about nothing in that post, as far as I'm concerned.
If you were to try to put yourself in someone's shoes that bumped into Epstein.
Yeah.
And for a long time now, he's been a household name.
Yeah.
Would you not get in front of that by months or years? Would you not right. If he were completely innocent, and it was, and I'm not talking about Michael Saylor in particular, I'm literally everyone in there.
Everybody, yeah.
But like, no matter how small it is,
right,
I would probably want to bring it up first. To me, it seems like everyone who didn't bring it up first is playing the game of, I hope it never comes out. And I could see how you could not, you know, hey, I bumped into this person. Someone roped me into this dinner date. I had no idea. And I hope that never comes out, because I could see how that's the wrong way.
I think Eric Weinstein kind of took that approach.
But he seemed to have gotten in front of it.
Yeah.
That's my point. Yeah. And to me, it's much more believable if you bring it up before the dump, mm-hmm. no matter how innocuous.
Yeah.
And I don't believe anyone who says, or I didn't bring it up before, why would I think of it? That to me wouldn't really fly. The craziest yeah. one to kind of get caught in this is Lutnick.
Oh, I haven't even seen those.
Lutnick has an email, though, where he tells a very long story about how, well, I don't know if you know Lutnick's address and why this is crazy. So Jeffrey Epstein lived at 9 East 71st Street between 5th and Madison. Lutnick lived at 11 East, 9-11.
Are you shitting me?
I'm not shitting you. Like, these things are hard to almost, like, it, like the universe to put these numbers together is hard.
That's wild.
They shared a wall, but 9 and 11.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
It's kind of crazy. So he tells a story where...
Dude, you got to get us out of the chicken coop here, buddy.
And I think Brian Johnson's in the same spot where, you know, one email comes out.
You mean Brian Armstrong?
Right.
Brian Johnson?
The guy who's trying to live forever.
Oh, you were talking about him. He's in the Epstein list too?
Yeah.
Dude, you're spending too much time on it.
Well, they just...
I'm just kidding.
Well, it's information. It's titillating. Yeah. But you don't really get anywhere. You don't know what's really... You don't have context. It's endless.
Yeah.
But you're getting snippets. And you're trying to piece things together.
My context is that if you were a person of power, influence, knowledge, developing new technology... Epstein and the powers behind him were going to try and get their fingers in your pot.
Right, but there were the people who were saying, look, I only met him once, and I didn't bring it up first. But then there were the people, I only met him once, and then the emails prove otherwise.
Everybody reacted a little bit differently. But there are people that committed heinous crimes, and they should be punished, and they should go away for a long, long time. And by us spending time on all these little connections just because someone's name was dropped, is missing the point. The point is, like, let's get the bad actors out of the system. Not everybody's a
bad
actor.
Do you think that's I don't think that's
The problem, right? By throwing this all out into the Twittersphere, you're getting all this, like, craziness,
right,
as opposed to law enforcement going in and taking out bad people. Which is what should be happening. That should be, those emails should be scoured for people that are incriminated in nasty activities, and those people should be taken off the scene. And unfortunately, the more time we spend on X just theorizing and wondering is cover for them to do nothing. We should be pushing them to make arrests for people that are named at doing horrible acts. And that hasn't happened. That has been there since the early days when this was uncovered in Florida and started getting covered up.
I mean, this goes back decades.
This is a decade or longer now where nothing has been done to bring justice for victims.
That seems to be a feature, not a bug here.
A feature, yeah, exactly.
All right. Michael Every says Trumponomics is reverse perestroika. I don't know if we have a clip here. But do you agree that stable coins are now tools of U.S. power? I mean, I would agree.
I mean, shout out to Marty for posting this, because this is fucking fire. Like, this is such a description of the way the world is being restructured. And we touched on this a little bit, and that because the U.S. has to pull back to become a regional power instead of the global hegemon, we're shifting our role in the world. And it looks like what we're trying to do is to increase manufacturing, right? And tariffs to become a manufacturer of goods. And while simultaneously pulling back on our global currency. So we can send you a stablecoin, like we described earlier. We can send you a stablecoin. We can keep the treasuries by friendly issuers of that stablecoin here in the United States that we have our thumb on. And in doing that, the only thing you're going to be allowed to do with those stablecoins, are you're going to be incentivized through tariffs to reinvest those into the United States to build out our manufacturing base. Now we've got a Fed that's aligned with that. When Warsh comes in, we've got Secretary of Treasury Bessent who's aligned with that. And they're trying to develop this whole new economic model where you don't have the Fed just buying all the debt. You're actually instead pushing it down to the banks to issue more credit, to drive lending. Instead of the banks just parking reserves of the Fed and earning interest, they want to incentivize them to lend them into the economy, to build, to create jobs, to create new businesses, to manufacture. Where it looks like we might be manufacturing, right, is in the military industrial complex first. I mean, we're even seeing that Elon is going to ship or discontinue two of his vehicles, and he's going to convert those factories to make robots. Now, if you're going to convert those factories to make robots, are those robots going to be military for rent? Do they have to go into the home to be your cleaner? Or could they be military for rent? Could they be manufacturing labor for rent, right? There's industrial, military and industrial use cases for these robots. And it simultaneously that supports everything else, or is everything else Trump is doing supports those efforts, right? Which is like, let's lock up raw materials. Let's get as much resource refinement as we can. Let's increase energy production. These are all things that you're due if you want to build a manufacturing base. The problem is he's got to make that shift like in 3 years. That we got to coming out of this in 3 years, like going, the shift's done, we look great, or else it could be a complete disaster going into the next administration that maybe starts to reverse some of this stuff. Right. So they have a very short time to make these changes. And that's the reverse perestroika example was where Russia was a military industrial manufacturing base that was trying to revert to a consumption population. And we're doing the opposite. So that's what they mean by reverse perestroika. We're going from a consumption based economy that consumes all the global goods to a manufacturer exporter. The key takeaway here is that in order to be that, the dollar will go down in value. So regardless what the Fed thinks about Bitcoin, or regardless of the strategic Bitcoin reserve, a loss of purchasing power of the dollar means Bitcoin is your life raft to retain purchasing power into whatever that future system is. Whether they're successful or whether they're not, you need that life raft.
Right.
And Bitcoin is that. So I don't know. I think everybody should, read this. I think it was brilliant, much better said than I could say it. And I think it's dead on.
You said it much better than I could read it. All right. SEC and CFTC urge rapid crypto rule updates. I think we can move through this.
Yeah. My biggest concern here is that, they're always under the gun to pass legislation, and then they pass stuff that's, you wake up one morning and it's like, they pass legislation, just turn off cars. ever get a proper opportunity to create good legislation because it's always under the gun. And so, yes, their urge for rapid rule updates. And does that mean we're going to get a shoddy, piece of legislation? That's my biggest concern.
Are the three pieces sort of like, which regulatory agency or agencies are going to have sort of dominion here?
Mm-hmm. That's part of it.
And then tax treatment, I don't think necessarily in terms of percentages, but
the taxonomy of crypto assets, who's regulating those crypto assets,
and who gets the yield? On the stable
on the stable coins?
Yeah.
Or the I guess deposits. That is a part of it. I mean, I think that's kind of bridging both the Genius Act and this act, because I think they want to be, you know, crypto exchanges like Coinbase want to be able to give rewards.
Right, but the banks don't want deposits, that.
Right.
Even though I think the banks own the Ethereum ecosystem, et cetera, and win both ways in a way. But
I mean, a lot of these crypto platforms are giving rewards via other means than treasury yield.
Right. So
that has to be cleared up.
Right. But in that sense, that all this has to be cleared up, do you think that there's any sort of non-zero probability that the price of Bitcoin, for several reasons, might have been suppressed in some way through narratives, maybe even selling old stacks that governments have control over? Anyway,
you're talking about like looking back in 2025
for all this to come together before the price of Bitcoin rise.
I think that was separate.
Or is this just a coincidence that this hasn't been worked out and Bitcoin price is low?
I think this is the legislative process at work, and it's.
But I think it works out really well for institutional adoption and sort of shaking out retail, in my opinion. I think retail hasn't come back. Mm. I don't think they're excited. I think there's a lot of negative FUD around narratives around core versus knots, around quantum, around Epstein.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All reasons, but smart money, and I would even include the smart investors in ETFs, can keep DCAing, can keep stacking, acquiring at much lower prices than anyone ever imagined. And then when the government gets what they need in place, which is none of this is really for the consumer. The consumer does it. Yeah, you could argue the CFTC is better for the consumer than that Senate Agriculture Committee. You can argue that this tax treatment would be better for the consumer. But I guarantee you the way they want to do the tax treatment is going to be worse for me. Mm-hmm. The yield thing I don't really care about as a Bitcoiner. So, but it just seems like a massive coincidence. And I think it goes along well with Trump's elected. People think Bitcoin's going to run. Maybe they levered up at 100, 110,000, 120,000. Maybe they borrowed against. 75K is a lot to shake those people out of their hands. It's a good shaking of the tree. It's a good scaring.
There's
retail off.
I don't think it's that well coordinated, but
it all seems to come together.
I do agree that there's been a persistent drumbeat of FUD to shake out a lot of new
overlaying a lot of when I say positive development, not fundamental change to the Bitcoin code, but you know, the repeal of SAB 121, the rolling out of SAB 122, the resulting Wells Fargo, Morgan's. I mean, lots of positive developments for the Bitcoin ecosystem. That I think if you would erase
the TradFi
2025, the TradFi Bitcoin ecosystem, which a lot of people think is going to put a lot of wind in the sails of the Bitcoin price. And you know, maybe Bitcoin eats Wall Street, but my point is we're going into 2026 with all those things at a 10x. Mm-hmm. So 10 times more development in the Bitcoin ecosystem going into 2026 than 2025.
Isn't that always the way it works out though? Like you see through every bear market,
but people are not 10 times more excited about Bitcoin.
No, that's the point. That's the point I'm saying is that every time we've gone through a bear market, or a big consolidated sideways action, always under the scene, there's an undercurrent of things being built. Very positive news that the market's not reacting to. And then eventually that stops and Bitcoin runs, right? I mean, we've seen it over and over and over again.
Sure.
Like in the face of the most horrific bankruptcies and fraud scams, et cetera, at the bottom of these bear markets, there was always an undercurrent of people building the new stuff. And
there could also be another FTX.
This is happening over a year plus consolidation band. We're getting a lot of FUD and uncertainty down, just dropping the markets here currently. But this entire year has been like putting in legislation, putting in rules, putting in guidance, cleaning up this platform for future expansion. Now we have a Fed chair coming in place that's going to work with the Treasury, we've got active movement on the front lines militarily and geopolitically to try and make America this manufacturing hub. We got stable coins in place, ready to, like, it's like, okay, we've got the players on the field, and we're getting, and they're getting ready to blow the whistle, you know, and start the game. Is the way it feels to me.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, I think around price, which is a fiat thing to begin with, they still have the referee. There's a lot of paper Bitcoin, a lot of ways you could, you know, and they have the referee over the greater economy. So they could rug pull other assets mm-hmm. that would cause a cascade throughout lots of assets. Mm-hmm. And we could be sitting here at, you know, $32,000 Bitcoin 6 weeks from now, mm-hmm. just like in March of 2020. I mean, the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is the volatility in a lot of ways, and that no one can really control the psychological reaction to this limited scarce supply. But I think it
changes. If you just look at the last, say, you know, 14, 16 months is a consolidation band that we're stabbing out of lower right now. Maybe that stab is temporary. But if you just looked at that as a consolidation band and not a bear market, you know, if it breaks out to the upside, it's going to go big. And then that could be the top. And then you could get a big bear market. Right. Or because time can be a bear market as much as price could be a bear sure. market. So you could just wear people out over time, right? I've been waiting for 18 months for this thing to go up, you know, and people just give up before it rips. Happens all the time in markets, right? So
do you think adoption year over year is up?
I remember, like retail adoption?
Yeah.
I think
global. I haven't heard anything about the class of 2025. Like we used to have, like, the class of 2030 and the class. Like, there is no class of 2024 to be spoken of, really. Or
right.
The name of the class of 2025. It doesn't feel like the class of
2025 is entities.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. That was the class of 2025. And
so you might have more capital adoption, but that's not sort of quantity adoption in terms of entities.
To give them the kudos they deserve, they absorbed a huge supply of Bitcoin. Right. A massive supply. I don't know how, 8 million Bitcoin changed hands, something like that, probably more than that now. I mean, they have just consumed a massive supply shift. So
do you, okay, I got another one for you. Do you think it's possible that there were early adopters of Bitcoin that are entwined with the state, like AKA Peter Thiel? Mm-hmm. And maybe Peter Thiel bought 400,000 Bitcoin in 2011. Mm-hmm. Is it possible someone like a Peter Thiel could sell 100,000 Bitcoin in throughout 2025, and then you throw in 100 other people like that, mm-hmm. that let's call those quasi-government stacks that they are selling to suppress price? I mean, is that outside the realm of possibility that some of the OG hands trading is price suppression? Is that far-fetched and it wouldn't be material amounts of Bitcoin out there?
Did they get an email or an instruction like you must sell? No, but could there be things like, hey, you know, it would be great if we're going to give you this XYZ contract deal with the Treasury that you could do something for us too.
Yeah. And maybe a bunch of people get that memo.
I mean,
and I know this is far-fetched, but I'm just...
But I don't think we need to worry about those things. I think what we
I don't think we have long term. I don't.
What we need to be aware of is that like 8 million Bitcoin changed hands and the price went sideways. That's never happened before. That's pretty crazy.
I wonder in percentage terms what the most, about 30% of the network.
Like, I think in the prior bull markets, it was almost closer to like 3
That's
million.
Almost 50% of like what you would think is movable stack based on how many are lost.
100%.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. That's
That's insane.
That's insane. So and, like, and but, you think about like in other bull markets, it was like about 3 million that changed hands near the top.
But I do believe that OGs, and I'm not saying nefarious ones, were able to liquidate coins they've always maybe wanted to liquidate, but could, would move markets back in the day.
Sure.
Or, you know, or, it would just send a bad message, I could
move
their family was done waiting.
2,000, 3,000 Bitcoin right. to this corporate entity, and I can liquidate it through Galaxy or whoever, and I can
or loan it and not get a tax transaction.
There's enough major buyers in the market now, class of 2025, the corporate right. treasury buyers, that I can bleed this stuff out without cratering my own position. Where if they had done that in 2017 high, 2021, 22 high, it would have been like silver was on Friday.
Right. Getting a clip, yeah. All right, I think we got one more clip before we roll out for today.
We actually don't have a clip for this one.
We
don't have the Jamie Dimon.
All right.
I wanted to see how he exactly said you're full of shit. He's such a gangster, JD.
Yeah. Well, anyways. I mean, we've seen this.
I think this is kayfabe. I think that he's in bed with Wall Street, Armstrong. Or...
Yeah, but is he custodying anything? He doesn't have, I mean, no, for JP Morgan, he's not working with JP Morgan directly in any specific way, is he? Are you aware of?
I don't know how that, but JP Morgan's an authorized participant. I don't know if Coinbase has any activity with the ETFs as a.
Well, I know they're custody.
So I don't know.
The Bitcoin for the ETFs.
Yeah, I don't know if they interface at all institutionally. I got to think more deeply on this. You know, is Armstrong, even if Armstrong is more aligned with, let's say, the stable coins, I believe that Jamie Dimon has a large control over the Ethereum ecosystem.
Yeah.
So Jamie wins either way is how I see it. And that's why Jamie can call Brian Armstrong full of shit or piece of shit. Because if Armstrong wins, Jamie still wins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kayfabe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Jamie gives a shit.
And I think that's why Armstrong's able to stay in this and even talk back to these people and allowed to live.
I don't know.
So I think the most empowering thing
for Brian is that he's custing a shit ton of BlackRock's IBIT Bitcoin, right?
Right. So I think then he definitely interfaces with JP Morgan as the authorized participant. Because they provide the ins and outs of the Bitcoin into the ETF and out.
Okay.
So they're picks and shovels. Jamie makes money every time the Bitcoin goes in and out or cash goes in and out of the ETFs. He doesn't own the ETFs.
Well, he doesn't get the
basis points.
We're lucky enough not to run in these circles, the way I look at it. And when you see these guys talk to each other, like Bessent and Powell are a great example, right? One report you're hearing about how they have breakfast once a week, and then the next report you're hearing Bessent say that the Fed is UBI for wealthy people,
right?
And that all the academic economists that they employ are useless.
Right.
So I think they talk very, very frankly to each other,
and I think they're in win-win situations.
At the end of the day, what works for my pocketbook. In your pocketbook is what we're going to make.
I think if anything, the fight's like 65-35, where we both win. But like if I win this argument, I get 65% of the pie, and you get 35. If you win, you get 65.
Right, something like that.
We're both walking away with hundreds of millions. One of us is walking away with billions.
All I know is that I buy Bitcoin, I put it in cold storage, and I'm very, very happy. Feel very, very comfortable with where I'm going.
Yeah, where we are in the world today, Bitcoin's the only thing you know is real.
Yep.
In terms of the asset goes. All right. Mr. Paul.
Stack your sats, people.
Another Bitcoin Center brought to you by Byte Federal. Please hit like and subscribe. Tune in every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Go to your Bitcoin Byte Federal ATM.
Leave a message here if you really want Cedric to get me out of the chicken coop.
We're putting walls in here on Monday.
okay.
Gonna insulate it.
That'll be nice.
It'll be a little more bug free.
Nice.
We'll get there.
All right.
Okay. Till next week.
Adios. Peace.